Okay, welcome everybody. This is the final office hours session for our third foray into man economy and state. And as usual, I'll throw it open to the questions. While you guys are thinking about questions to ask, I'll mention that my plan is to have the next big course come out sometime in mid-January, so to give people time to get back from their traveling and whatever and get back to work, but then not wait too long. And again, that's going to be on the theory of money and credit. So it'll be basically going through the theory of money and credit with the aim of having the student walk away with a full understanding of Mises' view of the business cycle. Okay, Bharat asks me, I remember you mentioning this before, but what is your opinion regarding whether increases in gold and silver with only 100% reserves can cause the business cycle? And can you link or suggest anything for me to read on this if it's a debated issue? Yeah, well, that's a good question. That's actually the forefront of something that's going on right now. So I am, hang on, I'm gotta sign into my Gmail account because David Gordon sent me something about this. So Brad DeLong actually has been on the war path lately, and I'm gonna write a response. Hang on a second here. Where is he writing? David, here it is. Okay, so David Gordon, so I had asked David Gordon if Mises ever said that. And so here's David's email to me, which I'm sure he wouldn't care if I read. He says, "Hi Bob, Mises deals with this problem in Human Action, pages 571 to 72 of the Scholar's Edition. He thinks that even a rapid increase in the supply of a commodity money would not have the same range of effects as credit expansion. A continuous increase in the quantity of commodity money can have an expansionary effect, but the market is able to adapt to this." So I haven't had time to go to Human Action and read the exact passages there on, he's saying 571, 572, the Scholar's Edition. So that's what Mises thinks. Now, I would need to go see the exact wording there. So in the theory of money and credit, Mises, and I know, Bharat, you asked me for my opinion, but let me just finish this train of thought. Mises clearly says that fiduciary media, an expansion of fiduciary media, always sets in motion the boom-bust cycle. Because, you know, when that extra money hits the loan market, it pushes down the interest rate below the natural rate, the rate that corresponds to the true supply and so true supplies of savings and consumers' demands for present versus future consumption. So that screws things up. So the issue then is, what if we had 100% reserves and then somebody finds a bunch of gold? Because Mises also has this view that money, qua money, even if it's commodity money, doesn't confer any social benefits. So a gold discovery per se, if all that new gold is used as commodity money as opposed to going into jewelry and dental fillings and stuff, doesn't make society wealthier. Whereas if somebody discovered a bunch of tin or a bunch of oil, then society would be wealthier. So for me, Bharat, I mean, I think at the very least, I could say if there are business cycles, they're going to be little dinky little things in practice compared to what's possible with credit expansion by commercial banks, particularly if they're folded up into a central banking system where there's a central bank that acts as a lender of last resort, and also if it's supplemented with deposit insurance so the customers don't care what the bank's doing with the money and don't care how what the, you know, reserve ratio is, because they figure my money's safe. If nothing else, the taxpayer's going to bail me out, and so on. So that's, and just to give you two quick things to anticipate what I'm going to write up on this. So there's one issue where even a huge influx of gold, that's just a one-shot deal. It's not going to be just a bunch of gold coming in year after year, probably. And when that kind of thing does, like when they say, oh, well, what about when the Spaniards went over and conquered the Incas or the, whatever the heck they conquered, I'm forgetting my world history at the moment, and brought in all this gold from the New World. I mean, that, I'm assuming that new gold didn't just show up on a Tuesday and that was it. I mean, it must have been a flow over time. But even there, I mean, we have to go back hundreds of years to come up with the kind of thing where you could say maybe the, you know, discovery of the California supplies of gold. But again, it's, we have to really scratch our heads and go back and say, oh, well, it's possible in a market economy there could be an influx of commodity money that's a huge increase in the, you know, the current quantity. But the fact that we can come up with two examples in human history, whereas if you say, oh, do you have any examples of where, you know, fiduciary media were expanded and caused a boom bust cycle? Well, yeah, every other boom and bust that we know about. I mean, that happens like every 10 years in a market economy. So there's that issue. Another issue is gold doesn't disappear the way that fiduciary media can contract. So I think that's really part of it too, that in the original Misesian exposition, it's not simply that, oh, the banks lower the rate of interest by injecting in all this artificial money, but also when they panic and they stop issuing new loans and then people pay back the other loans or they default on them, the money, the quantity of money shrinks. So, I mean, in terms of seeing why the economy go up and then totally crash, why do prices tend to go up and then crash, it's because the quantity of money expands and contracts. Whereas with money, with gold money, yeah, you can have these random discoveries of huge influxes. That's possible, but it's not like that's going to be counterbalanced then when once the recession kicks in, where people are all of a sudden going to take all that gold and go put it back in them underground and bury it and then forget where it is. So there's that issue as well. And then a final difference that I think is pretty relevant is, even if there is a discovery of gold, and it, you know, comes in, and let's say there's a huge discovery, and over the course of a year, the quantity of money increases by 10%, that's not all going to flow through the credit market. It's not like, you know, if there's gold miners out there prospecting, and, oh, wow, they find all this gold, they're not all going to rush to the bank and deposit that and lend it out. You know, they might spend a lot of it on consumption. You know, they'll probably go to, you know, if they're actual gold miners and the standard lore, they're probably going to go down to bars and brothels and spend a bunch of it too. So, yes, there will be rising prices, and there'll be Cantillon effects of them, you know, but the point is that huge influx of gold isn't first going to enter the market economy by being lent out by the banks. So the interest rate is not going to bear the brunt originally of accommodating this new influx of money, whereas when commercial banks decide to inflate through fractional reserve banking, then that is the first mechanism. That's the door through which all that new money enters the economy, is through the credit markets. So my point is, even if you postulated for the sake of argument an equal increase in the quantity of money on the one hand through fractional reserve banking, on the other hand through a gold discovery, in a system with 100% reserves, I think the interest rate would still be a lot more distorted through the fractional reserve banking mechanism, because the only way that new money gets into the economy is by being lent into existence. Whereas with the gold discovery, that you could argue that that would push down the interest rate below the, you know, the natural rate, but it would only be the fraction of that new gold discovery that is saved and invested. Whereas if they consumed it, so you spent it on consumption, that would push up prices, but it wouldn't distort the interest rate per se. So if you want reading on that, I have done an article. So in this particular article, I didn't take a position myself. I just summarized how, even within a Rothbardian framework, you could plausibly come down on either side of the issue. Namely, you could say, yeah, it's theoretically possible that a massive discovery of gold could cause a legitimate Austrian business cycle, or you could say, no, just by the nature of what of these terms, that's impossible. So remember, don't be confused. Murray Rothbard himself, at least as of when he wrote Chapter 12 of Man, Economy, and State, is saying gold discoveries in a free market cannot cause a business cycle. I mean, he explicitly says that in a footnote. And he defines inflation such that finding more gold is not inflation by definition. So we know what Murray Rothbard himself thought, but when I say someone who is a Rothbardian, what I mean is you could take other tenets of Rothbard's thought and construct a pretty plausible case that, no, it's got to be that theoretically it's possible gold could cause a business cycle. Now, for all this stuff, everybody acknowledges, even those who think it's theoretically possible, they acknowledge that in practice, having a gold commodity money and 100% reserve banking, any business cycle we encountered in the real world is going to be a drop in the bucket. Like, we might not even call it a business cycle because it would be so little. But the point is just theoretically, would it be a business cycle in the Misesian sense? Okay, hang on. Let me see if I can find that. Where is it? All right, let me just search my archives for the word gold. Okay, give me one more second. I don't think it's on my first page, but maybe it's on the next page. All right, well, unfortunately, the archive isn't working right. Like, it's not letting me go to the next page. I'm going to complain to them about that. Anyway, Barat, I don't know if any of you guys who are watching this know an article, but at Mises.org, I did, within the last year, write this up, where I just summarized the two different positions. So just to give you guys an idea, I mean, like, Stephen Kinsella thinks it's theoretically possible that you could have I don't want to put words in his mouth. For sure, he thinks that if you go out and found new gold, that would be inflationary and that wouldn't, you know, that could screw things up. I'm pretty sure he thinks, yeah, technically that could be an Austrian business cycle. How could you say otherwise? Whereas I think Walter Block would say, no, by definition, that can't be. Okay, let me move on then. So George Smith asks, on question 9 from quiz number 7, who is traditionally more to the right, Reagan, Hoppe, or Friedman? Can you explain the reasoning behind the answer? Well, George, the answer was Hoppe, right? Just make sure I don't explain the answer the wrong way. Yeah, okay. And when I, by putting the word traditionally in there, I meant in the standard spectrum of what most people who believe in this left-right thing where Stalin and Chairman Mao are on the left and Adolf Hitler is on the right, that clearly in those types of people's worldview, Hans Hermann Hoppe, who is a staunch defender of private property and doesn't want welfare handouts and is suspicious of immigration and stuff, I mean, he would be considered an extreme right-winger. I'm not sure. If you're asking me, Ronald Reagan would be on the right, Milton Friedman would be to the right of Ronald Reagan, and Hans Hermann Hoppe would be to the right of Milton Friedman in this standard American orthodoxy of what the left-right political spectrum means, whereas, you know, Barack Obama would be to the left of Reagan, and Paul Krugman would be to the left of Barack Obama, and Joseph Stalin would be to the left of Paul Krugman. So it's like more and more purity in their views. If you think with, you know, Stalin being a complete leftist and Adolf Hitler being a complete right winger. So if you're confused, George, because you don't understand what you, well, so George is saying, but I would think Hoppe wouldn't even be on the spectrum. Well, yeah, but then nobody should be on the spectrum. You know what I mean? So yeah, we're saying the spectrum is stupid, but then it's not that, oh, Hoppe doesn't belong. Well, why would Milton Friedman be on the spectrum? You know what I mean? That it's, or like Ronald, even Ronald Reagan, it's not like he's a complete authoritarian. You know what I mean? Like he favors lower tax rates. And so you could say, how is he to the right? And, you know, Adolf Hitler, it's not like Adolf Hitler's for zero taxes. Adolf Hitler's for the government completely controlling private business with all sorts of orders and commands. And that's not what Ronald Reagan is for. I mean, Ronald Reagan is for the drug war, but in terms of his economic views, he's more for individual liberty. So I'm saying, well, so George Smith is saying, but Friedman and Reagan both had roles for government, as do all members of the spectrum. Hoppe didn't, right? I mean, what you're saying is, you're right. The other people we mentioned do have, they're not anarchists, but the traditional left-right division is not over what they think the government ought to be doing. Because if it were, then Stalin and Hitler should be pretty close to each other since they're totalitarians. And yet, on that traditional spectrum, they're polar opposites. So that's showing this spectrum, the left-right traditional spectrum, is not placing people based on their view of what the government ought to be doing versus individual liberty. And that's kind of what our point is. That's why we're objecting to the spectrum. We're saying it's goofy. That it doesn't, the spectrum is not measuring, you know, it's not moving along the dimension of what is your view of the proper size of the government. So, I mean, Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama would be very close to each other. And John McCain and Barack Obama would be very close to each other in terms of what role do they see for the federal government in your life. And yet, on the traditional spectrum, John McCain is a right-winger and Barack Obama is a left-winger. So you're right, George, that you're, I think you're kind of saying, this spectrum's not very useful to me. I can't adequately, you know, it's kind of crazy that the spectrum is going to have Hans Hoppe being in between Ronald Reagan and Adolf Hitler. What the heck kind of spectrum is that? And I'm agreeing with you, but by the same token, what kind of spectrum has Adolf Hitler being the polar opposite of Joseph Stalin? So I'm sorry if you got confused there, but that wasn't supposed to be a trick question. I was just making sure you guys understood that somebody who writes for the New York Times who read Democracy, the God That Failed, would say, holy cow, this guy Hoppe is even more right-wing than Milton Friedman. Get this thing out of my face. What a crazy right-winger that guy is. So that's so yeah, if your guys' confusion was just you don't understand how the spectrum works, then I'm sorry, that was unintentionally hard question. But on the other hand, you should know, in terms of traditional American political analysis, Hans Hoppe would be considered a crazy hard right winger. And if you're asking, okay, but what specifically about his views? Well, because he is against government helping poor people, and he's for business, even though somebody who thought that, you know, wouldn't get the nuances of being a capitalist but not a crony capitalist, and his views on immigration especially. So now what is odd, you could say, but wait a minute, but Hans Hoppe is also against the drug war, so wouldn't that make him a leftist? And he's also anti-war, so shouldn't he be on the left wing? And you're right, you're correct, but his other views would trump that. So, I mean, it's hard for me to give you a rational explanation for why he's a right winger, because there are objections, but again, I think that just keeps coming back to the standard left-right spectrum is stupid. But I'm quite confident that if you asked a bunch of fans of Paul Krugman to read some of Hans Hoppe's writings and say, how would you describe this guy? Would you say he's a right winger? They would say, holy cow, he's a right winger. And you'd say, is he worse than Arthur Laffer and Milton Friedman? And they'd say, yeah, this guy makes them look like moderates. So, Barat comments on this as well. He says, I think it was just confusing because you would wonder what the word traditional meant. If it was the spectrum Rofford was criticizing or the spectrum Rofford wanted, but you could figure that out from the answers. Okay, yeah, so I mean, by traditional, I mean, so it's not like this is a modern invention, in other words, that by traditional, I mean like since the 1940s. I think when people talking about left versus right, this is what they would mean. So anyway, that's all I was going for there, and I'm sorry if it was unintentionally confusing. Okay, George Smith says, there are no expectations generally for more commodity money the way there is for fiat paper money. Is this not relevant to the business cycle? Well, here we get into a little bit of another theoretical difficulty. So, because I think an Austrian could answer either way on that, and so I think it's not like some clear matter of consensus. So, if you're asking me, I would say, yeah, that's very relevant. But there are other Austrians, I think, who would say, no, it doesn't matter. That. So here, let me just again be the neutral party here and just give you both sides of it. If one wants to say yes, expectations matter, this is the way I would do it, is to say, even if the commercial banks are inflating, pushing interest rates down, well, business people aren't necessarily stupid, right? They can know that that's happening, and what if they just refuse to make long-term investments? And they, so it, obviously if you're going to borrow money, then you're going to do it at the lower rate. You're not just going to throw money. You're not going to pay higher interest for no reason if you don't have to. But, you know, if originally the interest rate's 8% and you're running your profit and loss calculation, you just see some projects, okay, that makes sense. I would borrow and do that project at 8%. And now, because the commercial banks inflate, the market interest rate drops to 5%, you'd still borrow the money and do that 8% project, but you might not do one that would only make sense if interest rates were 5%, because you're thinking, I don't want to get caught with my pants down, interest rates are going to shoot up again. So, since the essence of the business cycle, as Rothbard himself emphasizes, is business people making errors, then I would say, how could expectations not play a central role? Because the only reason a business person is going to mistakenly make an investment is if he has a bad expectation of the future. So for me, I think the classical Austrian business cycle theory story does have to involve how manipulating interest rates screws up the expectations of business people. And so because of that, I don't think lowering interest rates automatically has to cause a boom-bust cycle, because it's possible that the business people don't make a bunch of malinvestments. But now on the other hand, you could argue, well, and some people have, and incidentally, what I just said, that's the strongest, in my opinion, mainstream objection to the Austrian business cycle theory. It's called the rational expectations objection. They'll say, you know, you Austrians are so big about how entrepreneurs are good at forecasting the future and they're weeded out over time if they're morons. So you're saying, you know, we've had fractional reserve banking for centuries. The Fed's been around since 1913. You Austrians have been writing books and publishing articles on this stuff since the 20s at least. And you're telling us that for some reason, businessmen, every time the banks lower interest rates, the business people say, oh, good, I guess there's more savings. Let me go invest more. And then they continually get surprised every time interest rates go up when the banks tighten. That's stupid. So in response to that kind of objection, there's another line of attack advanced by, oh, man, one of those guys' names. It's funny, I can picture what they look like. I can't come up with their names, though. Is anyone who's tuned in right now, do you know what I'm talking about? It's the, when they liken it to a prisoner's dilemma. Anyone? Bueller? Okay. Ah, they even won an award. Oh, man, this is killing me. I think one of the names is Greg, but that's the first name. It doesn't help you too much. Anyway, they wrote up a thing where they likened it to a prisoner's dilemma, and they were saying, it's even if everybody knows we're in an unsustainable credit expansion, your individual incentive is still to borrow money and go invest, even though you know that we can't all be successful. So you're just hoping to get in and get out before the thing turns, and that you can't just sit idly by while all your competitors are borrowing cheap money and expanding their businesses and stealing your customers. So, no, Bharat, that's not who I'm talking about. So that's, I'm trying to, so the way, when I would teach that to my undergraduate class, the way I would present their opinion is to say, if it's sort of like if the fractional reserve bankers just print up a bunch of money. In reality, they can't print money, but just to keep the analogy. And they go into the middle of town and just dump the big pile of money in the town square. And right now, other people are borrowing money from banks at 8%. And they say, hey, we're lending money out here at 5%. Clearly, people are going to start doing it. So the market rate of interest is clearly going to drop. And then, you know, can you prevent... Surely some people will try to borrow that money and do a project and get in and get out before the thing blows up. And then once some people start doing that, then how can you ignore it yourself? And so it kind of looks like there's clearly doing that is going to screw things up. People are going to behave differently. They can't all act as if the interest rate's really 8% when in fact it's 5%. That's going to alter behavior. Gene Callahan has used the analogy of a price control, and Gene said something like, well, let's say there's a blizzard, and normally, you know, the price of canned goods and flashlights and batteries and bottled water would go up, you know, since the town is isolated from the outside world, and maybe everyone's going to be stuck for several days without access to the outside world, so the available quantity of goods like, you know, tuna fish and flashlights and stuff would normally shoot up, but then the local government passes a price control, you know, price ceiling ordinance. Oh, no gouging our hapless citizens in this time of emergency. You evil merchants can't raise prices and take advantage of them. So, of course, what happens when there's shortages? And so Gene's point there was, even if every single consumer in that whole community understands basic economics, and knows, oh, if you impose a price ceiling, there's going to be a shortage, they still can't, it would be no contradiction to still say there's going to be a shortage, right? The people who go to the convenience store when batteries and flashlights and stuff are still priced to what they were before the blizzard struck, they would be doing nothing irrational if they cleaned out the shelves. even though they would know, oh, really, if the government hadn't passed that ordinance, these batteries would be costing twice as much, and I wouldn't buy as much. What do they care? Right now, the ordinance is in effect, and they were the lucky duck who got to the store first, so why wouldn't they just buy a bunch of bottled water and tuna fish? So Gene thinks it's analogous with credit expansion, that even if everybody knows Mises and Hayek, every business person, if the banks push down the interest rate below its market clearing level, that's going to cause business people to start projects that are unsustainable. So I don't think that analogy is quite right, because there is a difference. When we clearly there has to be a cluster of errors in to have an Austrian business cycle. So if you're the first person to the convenience store and tuna fish is underpriced relative to the market clearing level, you're not making a mistake by dumping all that into your grocery cart. You're doing it because it benefits you, and it's not like when you get home and you have all that tuna fish in your shelf, you're going to say, oh, man, what did I buy so much tuna fish for? No, you're going to be glad you did. That's why you're doing it. That's why the demand went up. The demand rationally went up for the canned goods and the bottled water when there's the blizzard. So I'm not – and then Gene tried to come back to me and say, yeah, but I'm saying, like, the fact that a lot of people are going to get to the convenience store and be and find the shelves empty. And so they're going to be, like, slapping their heads saying, oh, why did I go to the store? You know, I wish I had just stayed home because now there's no food for me here. Why did I waste my time coming to the store? Yeah, I guess. And it's true that it's the government screwing with the price system that made that happen. But even there, if people's expectations were really good and you knew there's no way I'm going to get to the store on time, like if you lived way the heck out in the boonies, and you had to get on your snowmobile to go into town, you might just stay home, knowing by the time I get there, because the government passed this price ceiling, there's no way there's going to be any tuna fish left. So there would still be a shortage, right? So a shortage is not defined by people who show up at the store and can't buy it. A shortage means somebody who wants to buy at the market current posted price and yet doesn't, you know, is stymied. So the fact that you're staying home because you know there's no point in driving out there, you still have a quantity demand for that thing that's going to be unsatisfied. So there's still a market shortage, even though you're not wasting your time. So I don't, again, you know, Gene's back and forth with me really pushed it, but I still think he's wrong. I don't think a standard price ceiling, if everyone did perfectly respond to it and had expectations and everything that were correct, there'd still be a shortage, even though the people in the market would adjust their plans around the shortage as efficiently as they could and minimize the impact of it. Still, there's a shortage, whereas with Austrian business cycle theory, if everybody were omniscient, there couldn't be a business cycle by definition, because a business cycle relies on a cluster of errors. And so if you're omniscient, you can't make a mistake. So how could there be a business cycle if everyone's omniscient? So to me, the standard Austrian business cycle theory story has to involve people making mistakes. And so if you're going to blame it on the banks tinkering with interest rates, I think a necessary component of the story is you got to say how tinkering with the interest rates messes up people's expectations. And incidentally, I did write up a journal article on that. I mean, it didn't get published, so I don't know what you want to call it, a journal article. But I mean, it wasn't like a little Mises.org thing. I mean, I was trying to get it published, where I put in a rational expectations model. Like, it was a formal model that satisfied all the Bayesian probability and all that junk. And the way I modeled it was, I said, imagine that the interest rate gives a signal to entrepreneurs. And if it's the actual, you know, natural interest rate, free market interest rate, it's a very accurate signal. Whereas if the banks screw with it, it's a noisier signal. So I still had rational expectations where the people in the market, the investors, knew that whether the banks were screwing with the interest rate or not, and so they adjusted their probabilities accordingly. But the point was still, it was a signal that conveyed less information the more, you know, if it were manipulated by those banks. And so in that framework then, I showed how on average, when there's manipulation of the interest rate, investors will tend to have more bouts of widespread overinvestment or investment in things that they shouldn't be investing in. So I, in my little model, that was the definition of an unsustainable boom. And then also there would be times when they would miss, you know, they would refrain from investing in things they ought to be investing in because they weren't getting a good enough signal, and so they were timid. And so I was saying, I think that messing with interest rates not only can cause booms and busts, but also can cause lower long-run economic growth because investors are less likely to dump their capital in the lines where they really ought to be doing it because they're timid since the central bank screws everything up. And but in that frame, to make that, so I think that is kind of cool. And I did try to get some empirical data that confirmed that, or not confirmed it, but was consistent with that. But the downside is for some Austrians, I had to concede that the way I defined what a boom-bust cycle was, that in theory, even under market economy, you could have a boom-bust. Just what if there were a cluster of errors that happened? And I, you know, still, I don't even see how Rothbard could get around that. I mean, theoretically, isn't it possible that every single capitalist could make a mistake at the same time? That's theoretically possible, right? There's nothing in praxeology that rules that out, and so you could have a cluster of errors, cluster of, you know, malinvestments that all happened last month simultaneously, that then, you know, a year into it, all those entrepreneurs are going to slap their heads and say, what the heck were we thinking? Why do we hire so many workers? Why do we start all these projects? We got to lay people up. It was sure on paper and in reality, it would sure seem like a boom bust. And I'm saying, there, you know, I think that's theoretically possible that could just happen even in a pure market economy. But of course, in practice, there's all sorts of reasons it wouldn't happen. There's all sorts of market mechanisms that would make that unlikely. But my point is, isn't that theoretically possible? So anyway, I intended to answer your question. I think was that Barat who asked that? Or maybe George Smith, I'm not sure. Oh yeah, where is this? Yeah, George Smith. I intended to just be neutral there, but you could see as I was talking, I convinced myself that I think the expectations are a crucial part of the story. If you guys are interested, if you guys send me an email, anyone who's hearing this and wants to see, I can email you that the paper I'm talking about. So it was unpublished, but it will, you can see more precisely what I'm talking about there, about how I came up with this rational expectations model with all the bells and whistles to in my mind, deal with the rational expectations objection. So the whole point of that is I was trying to show, look, I can give you a formal model that obeys rational expectations the way mainstream macro models do nowadays, and manipulation of the interest rate leads to a more severe and more frequent boom busts than would otherwise occur, and B, slower economic growth than would otherwise occur over a long period of time. And I even twiddled with the parameters, you know, twisting the dials of my model so that I could show, look, here's an economy, a little hypothetical economy, where if the government doesn't tinker with interest rates or the commercial banks don't tinker with interest rates, over a 100-year period, there would be less than a 1% chance of ever seeing one business cycle. But if they tinker with the interest rates, every 10 years, there's a, you know, 50% chance of a business cycle. You know, I'm making up those numbers, but I had results like that to show, you know, my theoretical framework. You could plug in parameter values to get things that come very close to saying in a free market, there's not going to be a business cycle for all intents and purposes, whereas with government intervention, business cycles are going to be frequent. Okay, let me make sure I'm not missing anybody's questions here. Okay. Lewis says, who do you think has been the American president ideologically closest to the Misesian framework? And then he also asked, will the final exam be available this coming week? Let me deal with that one first. Yeah, so it'll be like it's quiz number 9, right? So it will go active on Friday morning. What is that, Friday, December 2nd? And so yeah, just it'll have the same timing as if it were quiz number 9. And let me just make sure I put that on my schedule and post that thing. Yeah, let me write that down. And so before, you know, after I write it up, I'll send out an email telling you guys this is the structure, this is how you should study for it. And it's going to be, if you've taken my classes before, as I know you have, it's going to be par for the course for you. It'll be the same kind of deal. Okay. So then back to your question, who do you think has been the American president ideologically closest to the Misesian framework? I don't know enough history. I mean, this is a question Tom Woods would be better, or Ralph Rako. I have a soft spot in my heart for Calvin Coolidge because, and I mean, you could give the answer, like, who's the guy that died after a very short term in office? I mean, technically, you could say that guy because he didn't do anything. But that seems kind of like cheating. When I did my research for my book on the Great Depression, let's pause for commercial identification. I'm talking about the politically incorrect guide to the Great Depression and New Deal, word from our corporate sponsors. These office hours are brought to you by Regnery Publishing. When I was doing the research for that book, yeah, Calvin Coolidge succeeded Warren Harding. And even the story there is cool. Coolidge was like at his dad's farm, like pitching hay or something. I mean, seriously, like I'm not getting the details quite right. I have to go look it up. But I mean, he's literally doing manual labor at his dad's farm or something, or maybe his farm, I don't remember. And they get the telegram saying the president died, so now you got to get sworn in as the new president. And it was like, I think his dad was a justice of the peace or something. It was a cool story. And just to show that it's not like he was out at Martha's Vineyard sipping champagne and reading Karl Marx, who I'm getting at. So, not that the current president does that. So, anyway, my point is, Coolidge, I had known this before. If you come up in the, see, here's what I'm going to say, in right-wing circles, by which I mean people who want to cut taxes on rich people. So that's what you guys were asking before. What does it mean to be a right-winger or a left-winger? That's a huge thing. That's almost a trump card. If you want to cut taxes on rich people in the current American Rachel Maddow kind of universe, you're a right-winger. Especially if, you know, to say, well, do you want to cut food stamp spending by the government? If the answer to that is yes, then it's like, okay, you have to be a right-winger. You can't believe those things and not be a right-winger. So Calvin Coolidge, he had one of the, so income tax rates were very high at the end of World War I, and then under Harding and Coolidge, they brought them down substantially, and the federal income tax receipts basically stayed flat for a while, and then when the boom really kicked in 1926, tax receipts exploded. So in terms of like an illustration of the Laffer curve or showing, look, you can reduce marginal income rates, especially on the wealthiest Americans, and that won't punch a hole in the federal deficit or budget, and also you can have prosperity. The 1920s are like Exhibit A. You know, the Roaring Twenties when they did this. Calvin Coolidge also, every single year he was in office, ran a budget surplus. And I think federal spending was actually lower when he left office than when he came into office. And this is during probably the most productive, prosperous decade in U.S. history. So, I mean, you know, any other normal president, if he had just, like, limited the rate of government spending as a, you know, if he had just maintained federal spending as a share of GDP, you might be happy with the guy. Like, okay, he let government grow, but only as big as the economy was growing under his. But no, Coolidge was awesome in terms of his fiscal policies. He paid off a big chunk of the World War I debt. Right? So it's not merely that it's not even like he just balanced the budget. He was running surpluses and paying off government debt at a pretty substantial clip. So in the midst of this general prosperity, which is, again, all the more impressive that he was able to be so frugal when it seemed like, hey, money's flowing around, times are good, why not be a little bit more liberal with your spending? And then also, his rhetoric was great. And there's actually a YouTube of him giving, I don't know if it's his inaugural address, but something early on in his administration, he's given this talk, and his rhetoric is amazing. I mean, he sounds like, you know, he's getting notes from somebody at the Heritage Foundation or something. So anyway, so I actually, as far as American politicians go, I was incredibly impressed by him when I did research for that book, and I learned more about him. So he's one guy. Harding actually is cool too. Let me make sure I'm got the right guy here. I'm gonna. Yeah. So Harding, also, I mean, Tom Woods, I think, also has a soft spot for Harding. So Harding was what, after Wilson and before Coolidge. So Harding had Coolidge as his vice president. Let me just make sure I'm not saying something stupid. Bob Murphy, author of a book on the Depression, screws up Warren Harding. Calvin Coolidge, vice president, is that right? Yeah, okay. I'm just making sure I'm not. It's a Saturday morning. I haven't had coffee. I just want to make sure I'm not saying getting their names mixed up. So, so Harding comes in after Wilson, but then dies in office, and then Coolidge takes over and then, you know, gets reelected. But Harding was actually a cool guy. He's plagued by all these scandals and modern leftists, I'm using the left-right spectrum myself there, historians would think, oh, Warren Harding was this, but Tom Woods was defending him and saying, oh my gosh, in the grand scheme of things, what the heck, so what did Harding, I mean, yeah, he wasn't, you wouldn't want him to be working at your church, but it's not like he was this qualitatively worse politician than anybody else. And to his credit, Harding, so during World War I, Eugene Debs, the socialist, got locked up for protesting the war. And, you know, the great liberal progressive Woodrow Wilson was, of course, in office. So Woodrow Wilson is fine with imprisoning Eugene Debs, and then Harding pardoned Debs like right before Christmas and said something like, you know, gee, let the guy go have a Christmas turkey with his wife or something like that. I mean, so this, that's a very noble thing to say. I mean, especially for a Republican, and, you know, you think guys want to be tough on law and order and stuff to pardon a socialist who was criticizing America's entry into the war. I mean, think back, this is in the 1920s. You think of how fervent, you know, American patriotism and rah-rah, and anybody who's against us is, you know, a commie who needs to get locked up. And then for him to pardon the guy and say, geez, let the guy go have dinner with his wife for Christmas. I mean, that's kind of a cool thing. So anyway, he's cool. And then, yeah, sure. I mean, Thomas Jefferson or Grover Cleveland did some cool things. Martin Van Buren, people are suggesting in the notes here. Yeah, I mean, like I say, there are a few that are better than others from our point of view. But yeah, Grover Cleveland's pretty good too. And but I'm not gonna explain why because I'm gonna botch the details. But I remember reading about Grover Cleveland, thinking all around he's a pretty good guy from a libertarian perspective. But of course, it's true. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, but the guys that are considered great presidents are just uniformly awful. That, you know, like the way you become great is by blowing people up. I mean, it's pretty good if you expand government and take more of taxpayer dollars and spend them on stuff. I mean, that's okay. But really, to be a great president, you have to have a bunch of people killed while you're in office. And I'm saying that, I'm trying to be cheeky about it, but that is the pattern. I mean, the greatest of all presidents is Abraham Lincoln. And he killed hundreds of thousands of actual Americans. So you would think, you know, that if anything, he ought to be considered, not necessarily you could say, oh, well, he had no choice, but that shouldn't be great that happened on your watch. You would think a really great president would have made it so that that wasn't necessary. But yet, he's considered great. And, you know, FDR, Woodrow Wilson. Okay, let's see. What else are you guys talking about here? George Smith says, Senholz, I believe, said that any inflation causes business misjudgment, even if it's very slight. Well, and that might be true empirically, George, but I mean, once we leave the realm of, and maybe I'm playing my Hayekian cards here, and somebody like Hans Hoppe would get mad at me, but I think, you know, praxeologically, we can talk about action, the logical implications of it, but if you start talking about people making mistakes, to me, that you have to have some theory of knowledge and expectations formation, and I would be okay if you say other things equal, inflation is going to cause more errors than would otherwise occur. I guess I don't even have a problem saying that. In fact, I'm fine saying that. That's kind of what my paper was doing. But to me, that's not the same thing as saying inflation necessarily causes errors, or that a cluster of errors can only occur if there were a preceding bout of inflation. See what I'm saying? And it seems like some Austrians want to say that stronger thing, that you can only have a boom bust if there had been some sort of intervention in the market. And if we're defining a boom bust as a cluster of errors that leads to an unsustainable expansion that then collapses with layoffs and stuff like that. I mean, look at it this way. Certainly Murray Rothbard says there can be a bankruptcy in a free market. You know, a particular entrepreneur can screw up, misjudge what customer demand is going to be 2 years from now, hire a bunch of workers, start building factories, da-da-da-da-da, and then 2 years into it says, oh, man, I totally misjudged the market. I got to lay everybody off. I got to sell my, you know, shut down, just sell off my capital equipment to the highest bidder and liquidate my assets, and I'm still going to be in the hole and just declare bankruptcy, and, you know, my creditors can get a few cents on the dollar. Clearly, that can happen even under a free market, even though there's a profit and loss system, and even though there are incentives in place to try to minimize that kind of thing. Clearly, it can happen. So if you admit that it's possible one firm can screw up and do that, I don't see how you could say apodictically we know is a law of human action, it's impossible for 1,000 entrepreneurs or for 10% of all entrepreneurs to do that at the same time. I mean, you could say it's very unlikely, but how can you say it's impossible? And so I think you get dangerously close to just using definitions and saying, well, even if every entrepreneur totally screwed up and made a huge male investment, and then we had this wild upswing in apparent prosperity, there was tons of capital consumption, unwitting capital consumption, and then there was 90% unemployment when, you know, business had to lay everybody off and resources had to get reshuffled for a year, and the aggregate price level went up 30% and then collapsed 20% because of, you know, the differences in the demand to hold money and all that stuff. Even so, that wasn't a business cycle. That wasn't a boom bust cycle because I can't find any government intervention. So no, that wasn't a boom bust. That's what I'm saying. If you want to go that route, okay. But I think, you know, Austrians want to be able to make more of an empirical claim that what you guys are all saying with your observation is a boom bust cycle. We're claiming that that only happens when there's government intervention. And so any non-Austrian who just witnessed the episode I just described would say, yeah, that's a business cycle. Give me a break. And so I'm saying theoretically that could happen even if there were gold money and 100% reserve banking and Rothbardian utopia. Oh, right. Nathaniel is bringing up Andrew Jackson. The problem with Andrew Jackson is, I mean, yeah, Andrew Jackson's monetary view thing. Oh, the other thing about Andrew Jackson, he paid off the national debt. So not only did Andrew Jackson run budget surpluses like Calvin Coolidge did, but he literally paid off the national debt. Uncle Sam didn't owe anybody any money, at least at one point in Andrew Jackson's presidential administration. So I mean, that's amazing. But on the other hand, I mean, he slaughtered a bunch of Indians, American Indians. You know, so he, the Trail of Tears and all that stuff happened under Andrew Jackson. So it's, I mean, he's not. In some respects, he's a libertarian hero, but in other respects, he's not. And it's, you know, whereas some of these other guys, you could say at least they didn't kill a bunch of people. All right, let's see. Nathaniel also says, Harding and Coolidge were presiding while the Fed was creating a great stock market bubble of the 1920s. Right. I mean, that is true, and I would blame Coolidge more than Harding for that. So like I said, nobody's perfect. I mean, even Thomas Jefferson did the Louisiana Purchase. And what do you do? Is he the shooting cannons, the Barbary Pirates or something? I think so. I'm just really, hopefully I'm not totally displaying my ignorance here and get my presidents mixed up. Let's see. Jefferson, Barbary Pirates. Yeah, that's okay. So, yeah, there's nobody that's going to be perfect from a libertarian perspective. But the thing with Coolidge, too, is unfortunately, because I could give him a pass and just, you know, Coolidge did what he could do from his angle and just didn't try to abolish the Federal Reserve, because you could say, you know, maybe he knew politically he didn't have the power to do that. But unfortunately, when I was doing research for that book, I mean, Coolidge did say some stuff that I don't remember the exact words, but he either gave some speeches or wrote some things that made me think, oh, shoot, Coolidge doesn't see the problem here. You know, so it's, I'd like to be able to say Coolidge wasn't for that stuff, but didn't think you could stop it. And so he was just running surpluses and keeping taxes low and doing what he could. But unfortunately, like I said, I think Coolidge said some stuff during the bubble years that led me to believe he thought that was just, yep, this is the prosperity that my policies have yielded, and that's why the stock market's booming, and we're, you know, America's great USA, rah-rah, 1928. I kind of think Coolidge thought that, or at least publicly made it sound like that was his view. Okay, Anthony Zeger, and we got about 2 more minutes, guys, so I'll answer these remaining questions here, but then I'll have to shut it down. Anthony says, on page 1006, footnote 113, Rothbard says the deflation will not cause malinvestment because there will be no excess investment in lower orders. But if the shorter structure uses different processes than the longer ones, wouldn't there still be a malinvestment and result in a less efficient structure than would otherwise have been created? Hang on, let me just pull that up to make sure I kind of remember what you're talking about, but let me just make sure I'm seeing the context. And I don't know about you guys, but I've had my man economy and state on my desktop for several months now. All right, so you're saying page 1006. Footnote 13. Okay, so let me just read the footnotes. We're all on the same page here. So this is footnote 113 on page 1006. So in the text, let me read the text for, you know, the main text, then I'll read the footnote. So the main text says, it may well be true that the deflationary process will overshoot the free market equilibrium point and raise price differentials and the interest rate above it. But if so, no harm will be done, since a credit contraction can create no malinvestments and therefore does not generate another boom-bust cycle. Right, so now there's a footnote at that point that says, if some readers are tempted to ask why credit contraction will not lead to the opposite type of malinvestment to that of the boom, overinvestment in lower-order capital goods and underinvestment in higher-order goods, the answer is that there is no arbitrary choice open of investing in higher order or lower order goods. Increased investment must be made in the higher order goods in lengthening the structure of production. A decreased amount of investment simply cuts down on higher order investment. There will thus be no excess of investment in the lower orders, but simply a shorter structure than would otherwise be the case. Contraction, unlike expansion, does not create positive malinvestments. Okay. All right, I think, Anthony, what he's saying is, let me first try to paraphrase what he's saying, and then we'll think about, did he cover all the bases? So I think what he's getting at is, if you, you know, we have an original equilibrium, everything's fine, and now there's credit expansion. So now all of a sudden the entrepreneurs get a bunch of fiduciary media handed to them. What do we do with it? And they are going to go invest in higher order stages, and that lengthens the structure of production. Now, and that sets in motion, you know, so now, there's not enough real savings to bring all those processes to completion. And so, and, you know, at some point down the road, they're going to slap their heads and say, oh my gosh, we got to lay people off, liquidate some of these processes. Okay. Start over. Now we're in an original equilibrium, and instead of the bankers dumping a bunch of new money into the system, all of a sudden they pull out 10% of the money. Now, can that cause a malinvestment? And Rothbard is saying no. I think what Rothbard is saying is no. All that would mean is now there's going to be less total investment, at least in nominal terms, than there was before. So that might cause the production structure to contract, you know, to shorten. Investments that would have been made in higher orders now won't be made, but it's not like people are going to be investing in things they shouldn't be, because, like, by construction, they have less money now to be able to invest. So I think that's what he's saying. Let me now reread. So now, Anthony, your comment is, but if the shorter structure uses different processes than the longer ones, wouldn't this still be a malinvestment and result in a less efficient structure than would otherwise have been created? We're over time at this point, so I can't give this. This is a really good technical question, Anthony, so let me just answer it off the cuff, because we're over time and I got to wrap this up. But if I am forced at gunpoint to give you an answer right now, I would say this. I would say, yeah, technically it could cause malinvestments in the sense that society would have been richer had they invested differently. So again, if we have an original structure of production, the correct one, And, you know, that's consistent with time preferences and all that stuff and technological possibilities. And now all of a sudden, there's a deflationary episode where the banks raise their reserve requirements and contract the quantity of credit and money. And so ideally what you would want to have happen is all the prices adjust instantaneously so that with the lower volume of expenditures, you're still maintaining the same real investments, right? You still want actual real resources doing the same thing period after period as was happening before the credit contraction. And so the only way that can happen is if prices adjust. Or I guess the velocity of money could go up. But let's just say, you know, the way to think about it is just if prices all go down, that could allow, you know, the quantity of money could still shrink and yet maintain the same spreads between all the stages, and business people could keep doing investing in the same, you know, sort of thing. But I think Rothbard is admitting, practically speaking, that might not happen, and you might get a contraction in the structure of production. And so I think what you're saying is, you know, wouldn't they be investing in a lot more lower order good or different processes? And yeah, that could happen, but I think, but it's not, I don't believe that they would then slap their heads a year later and say, oh shoot, we have to lay people off now. I think it's rather they might slap their heads and say, oh, if we had done things differently, we would have been more profitable, we would have earned a higher income, but I don't think it would set up an unsustainable boom. Right, and Anthony clarifies and says, because they use different processes, the longer structure does not just add stages to the shorter processes. After deflation, you could end up with shorter processes that cannot be easily lengthened by adding higher stages. Yeah, I mean, we are getting into a really technical issue here. I mean, you're right. Rothbard seems to be writing with the idea that you're just adding, you know, more floors to an apartment building, when your point is maybe after the deflation, you have a 5-year process that does things one way, whereas really there ought to be a 7-year process that does things completely differently. So it's not like those final 5 years are the same and we're just tacking on 2 years. You're saying, what if it's a completely different 5 years? So yeah, if originally the equilibrium is a 7-year production process, after the deflation, everybody invests as if it's a 5-year, and then 3 years into it, they say, what the heck were we doing? And then they try to revert to the original 7-year. I suppose you could have a boom-bust cycle in that respect. Yes, I get what you're saying, but I think it's more likely that you would just instead, they would be too cautious. So in other words, they would do stuff that would be able to be completed. Because the thing is, if the market interest rate goes higher than it otherwise should be, then in a sense that makes entrepreneurs invest less capital than really exists. So they're not going to hit a point at which, oh no, there's not enough bricks to go around the way they do with an unsustainable credit expansion. So, I mean, I'm almost positive that's the crucial point Rothbard's making, that, yeah, you could end up being poorer than you otherwise would be if you overshoot after deflation, but you're not going to set yourself up for a fall. It's just you're going to realize, oh, we didn't do things optimally. So I guess that's one way of putting it, that an unsustainable boom is not equivalent to just saying entrepreneurs make a bunch of mistakes. That there's actually, it's a particular category of mistakes where they start projects that can't be completed. Anthony says, so you'll end up with extra bricks instead of a shortage. Yeah, that's probably a good way to put it. That's a good job there. That So remember the, and then we really got to stop here, guys. The that's a great way to finish the analogy. So big picture, Mises' classic analogy for an unsustainable boom is that you've got a master builder who know, you know, he's got a certain amount of bricks, a certain amount of wood, glass, workers at his disposable, concrete, some construction vehicles. So he draws up the blueprints to use these resources to start building this big house. But unfortunately, the number he had in his inventory for how many bricks he had was wrong. So you start building the house with blueprints that end up with blueprints that say you need to use so many bricks, but you don't have that many. And so the point is, the earlier the guy realizes that discrepancy, the better, because then he's going to adjust the plans, because the more he builds, at some point he's going to run out of bricks, even though his blueprint called for using more, and then he's in trouble. And so he cannot finish, he physically cannot finish that house given the supplies available. So that's an unsustainable project. Whereas what would it mean to say credit deflation caused you to underinvest, but you could still call it a malinvestment, would be you start, yeah, you draw up the plans thinking you have fewer bricks than you actually have. So there, you're never going to hit a point where, oh shoot, I can't finish the house I designed. What's going to happen is, worst case scenario, and even there, the earlier you realize the error, the better, because you can adjust the blueprints midstream. But if you never found out, you could finish the house, and then you're left with 10,000 bricks. And you say, oh man, I could have made a much cooler house had I realized that. And now I'll do the best I can, and you know, take the bricks and go, you know, build a really kick butt dog house or something. But now I'm permanently poorer than I otherwise would have been. Had I correctly invested in knowing how many bricks I had originally, I would have ended up with a really cool house. Instead, I have a decent house in this amazing doghouse, which is better than not having the doghouse. But, you know, so it's good that I had the bricks. I'm glad, like, somebody didn't blow them up. But the point is, I would have done things differently from the beginning had I had correct expectations. So that's the way I personally, you know, if we're going to be making analogies, that's the way I would handle it. But however, Anthony, I think technically you're right. Is that possible? I think if we didn't just use the house analogy, but we actually got more specific about I could do it like this. I could say, what if you were really mistaken about how many bricks you had? Like, you thought you had 10, and really you had 1,000,000. So you might start designing a house that didn't use bricks at all, and we can supplement the story. And let's say that, you know, all you were using vines and stuff, and you were using really bad material because, geez, I only got 10 bricks. I can't make a house out of 10 bricks. And so you get the first floor done, and then someone says, whoa, we got 1,000,000 bricks. And you say, oh, my gosh, well, okay, we'll start from scratch then. If we got those bricks, we're not going to build a house out of vines. Knock that thing down, and we're going to start over. So there you really would have made male investments. And, you know, if there are certain guys who are really expert at cutting down vines, maybe they would, you know, have thought that was a boom, and all of a sudden they're laid off and I can't use them because I'm going to go back to building a brick house. So I think even there, yeah, you could come up with a story where it looks like a boom bust, but you do see the crucial difference that the sense in which it's unsustainable is because you're all of a sudden more optimistic. And so if you're ever going to be caught in an unsustainable boom, you want to be one where you realize it's, oh my gosh, we were being way too pessimistic. Let's stop what we're doing because we're far wealthier than we realized. I mean, so technically you could call that first house project an unsustainable project, but it's unsustainable not for physical reasons, but because that's going to give you so much less final satisfaction than what you're actually capable of doing. You stop and just scrap it. So I think you still see the qualitative difference between those two different things. Okay, well, I'll stop there, guys. And I will, I'll post. First of all, I'll catch up with all your questions in the forums if those are still pending, and then I'll tell you when the exam is, when I've written the exam, and tell you how to study for it. Okay. Why don't we turn off this thing?